is Justice Diane Sykes. We will now hear 02-2438D, Office of Lawyer Regulation versus Jeffrey D. Is it Nick Meyer?
Either way, Your Honor, Nick Meyer, or the more traditional dramatic Nick Meyer.
Nick Meyer, fine, good. And representing Mr. Nick Meyer is Mr. Nick Meyer. So, Mr. Nick Meyer, if you would take the podium. You have 25 minutes. Mr. Turkheimer, representing OLR, has 30 minutes, and you will then have 5 minutes in rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning, members of the court, Mr. Turkheimer and staff. My name is Jeff Knickmeyer, or more formally, Jeffrey D. Knickmeyer, the respondent appellant in this matter. And I am either appearing pro se or representing myself, depending on how you'd prefer to characterize it. And I would like to say that it is always a privilege to appear here and argue a case. I have not had that opportunity for several years, although I have in the past, and I wish the circumstances were better here today for myself personally, but it is nonetheless always a privilege to be here, and it's always enjoyable and always a learning experience. I would also ask the court's indulgence to forgive me because I am a little rusty. I'm out of practice making formal arguments. I've done some speaking in the past couple of years, but I perhaps do not have the familiarity I once did, so I apologize and ask your indulgence. It seems to me that the respondent appellant has had a difficulty in grasping the operative dynamics and what others seem to consider to be the really relevant issues, both factually and legally, in this proceeding. I think that's been one of the respondent appellant's problems, is kind of missing the mark in what to address and how to go about it. For that reason, I'm not really in a position to speculate as to what particular facts might be most significant or issues. So what I thought I would do is simply go through the issues that I have elected to raise in the brief and try and just briefly discuss them and then hopefully proceed with any questions, comments, or requests for clarification the various justices may have. I think this confusion is a byproduct of a new set of rules and a new system, in essence, and also the respondent appellant's historic lack of familiarity with disciplinary proceedings. So the statement of issues presented for review, of course, appears near the beginning of the brief, and it was difficult to determine what issues might be the most appropriate to raise at this juncture, keeping in mind that we're down the line quite a length of time in the period of temporary suspension and so forth. So I attempted to select the issues I thought were most relevant or appropriate or made the most sense at this juncture.
Mr. Knickmeyer,
yes, Your Honor.
If I might interrupt you at this point, because you're touching on something that I read with carefully, I think, in terms of your brief, and that was the argument that you made in regard to the temporary suspension and in regard to your claim of violation of due process. Let me ask it this way. As I remember the sequence of events that occurred here, there was a request by OLR asking that you be temporarily suspended. A copy of that motion was sent to you. The court issued an order to show cause asking you to respond to that motion, that request for temporary suspension. The motion by OLR was supported by an affidavit. You had the opportunity to and did respond to that request, to that motion for temporary suspension. And after all of this occurred, a temporary suspension order was entered by the court. Why do you think that sequence violates due process, since there was notice and an opportunity to be heard?
Well, the aspects you're referring to, Your Honor, are some of the standard indicia of what due process constitutes. But it was my impression, without having done specific research, and I will confess I did not pursue that at that time because I had hopes that some compromise would be achieved or that the court would perhaps issue conditions. My ideas were, in essence, confirmed that if you're going to proceed against what has been characterized as such a valuable property interest as a professional license, that it takes somewhat more if you're going to take that kind of step. In effect, sort of a death penalty almost, executing what is really the maximum type of penalty the court can hand out in a disciplinary proceeding, which is a suspension or revocation. In other words, taking your license away, and the only question is for how long. And I also want to make a point, Your Honor, I'm glad you brought this up, that as I understand the reinstatement procedure now, that is by no means an automatic procedure once the assigned period of 5 years or whatever period of suspension it might be has expired. There are any number of reasons someone suspended for 6 months might never be reinstated. So, but anyway, then upon doing the research, I found this, what I have characterized as a very nice which is contained in the appendix. It's only about 3 or 4 pages long, at page A44. And I'll be honest, I am not in the habit of necessarily agreeing with the Attorney General's office historically, either as a citizen or as an attorney representing someone, but I thought that the discussion was very appropriate and thorough, the progression of reasoning in the opinion, and also it relied principally on an important U.S. Supreme Court case, Berry versus Barkey, which dealt with the very issue of a temporary suspension of a professional type license. In that case, I think it was a racing license, so it perhaps didn't quite have the emotional or the equitable appeal some other license might have. But I think that's still good law, and I think that Berry versus Barkey is still good law. And as I have also indicated at various points in my materials and in my argument, I believe that the Attorney General's opinion I'm citing led to the development of present Wisconsin Administrative Code Section Chapter RL6, which appears at page A47 of the appendix. And I am trying to answer your question, Your Honor. So that opinion of the Attorney General outlined some specifics, and RL6 incorporated them almost directly. The notion that there's got to be some kind of hearing, it's got to be fairly prompt. I believe the Wisconsin administrative rule for most licensed professions governed under Chapter RL, such as nurses, physicians, and so forth. I think the hearing is to be held within 20 days, and then a formal disciplinary proceeding is to be commenced within 10 days thereafter. Now, at first, we might say, well, those are perhaps extreme time limits. They're difficult to deal with. Well, I'm sure sometimes they are, but it's been quite a few years since that Attorney General's opinion was issued, and I think we've had similar provisions in the administrative code for a number of years to govern other professions. And somehow they have managed to deal with that system and adequately protect the public. And we're talking about some very serious things. We're talking, for instance, about healthcare professionals such as nurses and physicians. A surgeon gone awry could certainly be something of great concern to the public physically as well as in other ways, or a nurse for that matter, or some other practitioners. But somehow that has worked. And, of course, as has been indicated and is the case, the regulation and licensing department or system or agency does not govern attorney licensing and attorney practice in Wisconsin. That is a uniquely governed and administrative area where actually in disciplinary proceedings, this court, the Supreme Court, the highest appellate court, is a court of original jurisdiction. And I will confess frankly, Your Honor, again trying to answer your question about why isn't this due process or what would be required, it's been a struggle for the respondent appellant to come to terms about the dual nature of the court sitting as a trial court, in effect, but also then as the highest appellate court. And I don't have a suggestion for how to solve that, and I apologize about that, but that difficulty has been reflected because the procedures in the ordinary perspective of this court are not those we ordinarily see in a trial court. And so I'm just indicating, I don't have a solution for that, but that's been part of the respondent's difficulty. And that is what I think the further requirements would be to satisfy due process in a case like this. Even though attorneys are not directly governed under that regulation and licensing system. And Berry versus Barkey dealt with a racing license for horses, I believe, not attorney licensing. Basic principles of due process and equal protection indicate to us that those kinds of basic parameters and principles should apply to this type of proceeding.
Well, is it your argument that there should have been a hearing before this court or a hearing before referee appointed by the Office of Lawyer Regulation, or what specifically do you think should have been required and wasn't required?
Well, Your Honor, you're kind of asking me to give an opinion as a consultant on the Supreme Court's rules, and
you've gone ahead and legitimately raised an issue, and so I'm not asking you to be a consultant. I'm asking you to explain to us what your position is.
Well, given the nature of that rule, I believe it's SCR 22.21, as of the date the investigation commenced or the temporary suspension motion was made in February 2001 or whatever date you want to pick, that rule in essence was unchanged. And, of course, the literal reading of that rule did not provide for any of those procedures promulgated by the Attorney General's opinion or under RL6. So you ask me a difficult question that has different aspects to it. Am I saying that there was not literal compliance with the rule as it existed? No. But am I saying that the rule in this unusual type of case was deficient? The answer is yes. And the answer is, has it had various consequences for the respondent appellant and been somewhat determinative of the position he presently occupies, both personally and in this action? And the answer to that also is yes. If nothing else, it's been a major distraction for the respondent appellant. And I'm happy to report that he has, although apparently not agreeing with the order for temporary suspension, scrupulously abided by it, and there's never been a suggestion to the contrary. But that is a problem always when we are looking at changing a historic holding of a court, coming up with a new policy or doctrine. What do we do with the interim cases? What do we do with those that are pending? And, of course, appellate courts sometimes make things only prospective in terms of relief. Sometimes appellate courts make things fully retroactive and actually sometimes open jailhouse doors. One of my favorite examples is the ruling in the case, and I cannot remember the name of it, on the Wisconsin temporary practice of a six-person jury trial in criminal cases. But anyway, what to do in this case is I would hope that the court could, first of all, get to the constitutional issues and aspects of that rule and commence whatever the appropriate procedure is to somehow change it for the future, and in this case do something to grant some sort of appropriate relief.
Counselor, did you ask for a hearing when you got the order to show cause?
Well taken question, Your Honor. Most definitely the respondent did not ask for a hearing. In fact, in terms of any direct request or demand for a hearing, the respondent has not yet to this day specifically demanded that in terms of a direct filing with this court.
Thank you.
And
are you the respondent?
Yes.
Okay.
And my question would be, well, if you... when you got the order, why didn't you not ask for a hearing, sir?
Your Honor, that's a good point. I addressed that a little bit. I want to address that both theoretically and also practically in this instant case. One of the things that occurred to me, Justice Rogensack, early on, was it would be nice and rather novel to attempt a jury trial demand in a case like this, because I concluded for various reasons, if that could in fact be granted, that would be advantageous. But I don't think historic practice of this court, the present state of the rules, nor constitutional requirements necessarily entitle one in the position of the respondent to a jury trial. And my experience with courts is that when you file demands of that nature or requests of things that are plainly not provided for under the present state of the law, that is not necessarily a sound approach in legal practice. Some trial judges, in fact, get downright upset. For instance, if you demand a jury trial in a certain type of juvenile case, or in some cases that are rather purely equitable in nature, trial court judges don't like that. Now, of course, they're sitting as trial courts. They can't change the rules and provisions anyway. But no, the respondent definitely did not. Now, coming back to Justice Wilcox, it's the same answer. At that point also, the respondent appellant felt that perhaps not taking the most aggressive approach, but perhaps being a little more passive or submissive, simply sticking with the temporary suspension for a time, hoping somehow perhaps a resolution of the case itself could be negotiated, was the appropriate course of action. That's not a legal question or legal issue. That's a strategic one, but I think that's the main answer to both of your questions.
So you had ongoing negotiations with OLR?
No. That according to the respondent appellant's position, that never occurred. That's just not how the system's programmed. And that was one of the difficulties, one of the dynamics, as I indicated, that was very difficult.
Well, this goes back to Justice Crooks's question about the question that you are raising on due process, particularly notice, and to satisfy the requirement, I'm just trying to go through the steps. And so you received notice, you did not ask for a hearing, because you were negotiating, and I don't want to put words in your mouth.
No.
You were not negotiating.
The main reason was there was no such provision in the rules. And at that point, the respondent appellant was not prepared to try and find relief by attacking a Supreme Court rule. And that was a conscious decision. There's no question, there has not really been a formal demand, but the rule under the present situation does not provide for it. That doesn't mean the respondent appellant is not necessarily entitled to a relief. I mean, as we see the historic process of due process in property cases, criminal cases, and forfeitures, usually courts don't say, well, you should have submitted all the demands for all the things you wanted. I mean, the question is, did the present state of the law or the rule or the provision or the statute at that time provide for that? And if, for instance, the respondent had failed to respond to the motion and the order to show cause, it might be then that the respondent appellant would have waived most, if not all, of his subsequent arguments, whether constitutional in nature or otherwise. But the respondent appellant did, in accord with the state of the rules at that time, in timely fashion.
Counsel, I'd like to get to the substance of the issues today, if we can. And there are several counts, and I won't do them or you justice, but I'm going to try and summarize at least them relating to one of your clients. And that is that you used funds of a client for your personal benefit rather than his. And I may be overstating this, but, well, let's take the airplane. Do you fly?
Not recently, Your Honor, but historically I have.
Does your client fly?
At that time, he had been a passenger with me on a number of occasions, both before and after the date of that loan in September 1980.
That's an essence of the charges. Maybe you think not. So why don't you tell us what you think is the essence of the charges and why you think they're not justified.
Relating to the loan, there is no prohibition in the rules, maybe there should be, about taking or entering into loan transactions with clients. The question is the terms and conditions have to be reasonable and fair to the client and so forth, and I'm paraphrasing that particular rule, which that's one of the things we've agreed on, does apply. And the respondent appellant attempted to prepare the paperwork and the security interest in a painstaking fashion, in his mind at least, writing it in a fashion so it would be advantageous to the lender, including the standard things we might see, one-year due date, default clause, provision for attorney's fees and costs of collection, a very high interest rate of 15%, and so on and so forth. Now, the Office of Lawyer Regulation did not take the same perspective on that, apparently considering that the high interest rate and those collection provisions and the fact it was characterized as not being a Consumer Act transaction, so forth, were of no consequence, as well as the fact, which was stipulated to, that the value of the collateral at the time was about 140% of the loan balance. So that's how the respondent appellant would tend to characterize
was
that loan.
Was the loan paid?
I'm going to try and answer your question, although it may seem I'm evading it. I'm not. The respondent appellant, in the midst of this pending proceeding, after complaint filing, long before hearing, thought it would be very nice to bring a resolution to the outstanding payment issue. He was unable to negotiate a resolution with the client's new attorney, although he was making $200 monthly payments while this particular client was in prison, to make sure he was provided for according to his reasonable needs. So a declaratory judgment action was commenced in Dane County Circuit Court, basically for the court to determine and declare that a balance was owing from the respondent appellant myself to the former client, and then to determine what is that balance. Well, unfortunately, that proceeding has not yet achieved final judgment for various reasons, I suppose. We did have a trial in April of 2003, which was presumably at least completed. And I see my warning light is on your end.
Counsel, just in that same area, now this loan came out of a trust account, correct? A trust account?
The first loan did not, Your Honor. That was before the time I had deposited any funds in my trust
account. But there was a trust account, and one of the charges, and I don't want to enumerate that, had to do with that the real estate taxes became delinquent because there wasn't liquidity in this account. That's the same account that this money came out of?
The real estate taxes were historically delinquent, and some monies were paid out of the trust account to pay real estate taxes, but at no time during the time when the respondent had control over funds were they paid up current. They were never actually paid up current, Your Honor. Some were paid, the remainder were not.
And they weren't paid up current, I understand, in reading the material, because there was no liquidity in the trust fund, the one that you were handling.
That's not correct, I would say, Your Honor. The respondent appellant made a conscious decision not to pay more than a certain amount toward the delinquent real estate taxes, and that became the specific basis for one finding of misconduct. And that is, in fact, the reality of the matter, because answering Justice Abrahamson's question in greater detail, at the time the trial proceeding commenced before the referee in September of 2003, the respondent appellant did tender what he had calculated based on his testimony in the Dane County Declaratory Judgment Action, a full payment. So that has been done, and that tender was accepted without acknowledging that was, in fact, full payment. And as I say, we have been unable to achieve that either through the circuit court resolution of a final judgment or a negotiated agreement. But that was approximately $9,200. And according to the respondent, that was his calculation of how that would be determined to be a full balance. One of the issues is whether the offset claimed by the respondent for attorney's fees performed over a period of a couple of years is valid or not. And it's my impression, at least, the circuit court has not really fully decided that yet and issued a formal reading. But that's an interesting point, because in terms of the disposition of these funds, there was that accruing balance there at all times.
I'm done,
Your Honor. Thank you.
As I understand your defense, is you engaged in a variety of financial transactions with your client to save him from himself?
That would be a valid, although general, characterization, Your Honor, yes.
As I understand it. And that your client had alcohol and drug problems.
There also is testimony indicating the respondent may have had reason to believe that some of these proceeds were being used to actually finance narcotics transactions, not just for consumption purposes. Yes.
Was he competent?
Difficult question. I have read and quoted in some of my briefs to the referee particularly. language from the comments to the rules and the preamble. It would depend on what day, Your Honor, and what time of day would be my precise answer. When he was under the influence or in great pain from some of his medical problems, no. He would have been under sufficient stress and inadequate of, or as we used to say, maybe not of sound mind at those points because of his medical problems, largely self-induced, and the influence of these substances. So at those times, he would not have been. Other times, yes, clearly met the definition of legal competence. And since I represented him in a number of criminal proceedings, it certainly would have been my obligation to raise that issue if I felt he was not. So in other words, when he was sober and clear-headed, yes. Yes, he was clearly competent.
And that's when you entered into transactions with him?
Presumably, yes. It would be the respondent's position and his testimony that all of these were talked about ahead of time in advance. And, for instance, the entire motorcycle transaction had the client there personally present for the whole thing and participating. But it's a difficult problem because we've talked about alternatives to doing the unorthodox, personally generated mechanism the respondent attempted. Could we do a spendthrift-type proceeding? Could we do this or that or these other things? And my response has been, first of all, again, quoting from the preamble and the comments to the rules, this is a most unavoidably difficult position for an attorney to be in, to use his knowledge to try and claim, you know, the client's not capable of managing his own affairs, and it creates multiple-level conflicts when you're representing him in legal matters. And naturally, the client doesn't want that. The client doesn't want to have his funds held in trust against his will or be declared a spendthrift. And another thing that the respondent did argue more recently is that nothing of that nature has yet been done. And he was very quick getting revoked and sent back to prison when he got out.
Mr. Knickmeyer, your time is up. You've got 5 minutes in rebuttal.
And I thank you all very much. You've been most gracious. I appreciate it.
Thank you, counsel.
Good morning, Your Honors. I'm Frank Turkheimer, appearing on behalf of the Office of Lawyer Regulation. To my immediate left is Ms. Nancy Warner, who was responsible for the investigation that has led to these proceedings. Let me start where Mr. Knickmeyer ended. Unorthodox, personally generated procedure. That's a very pretty euphemism for saying he was using the client funds to buy himself an airplane, to satisfy a longstanding interest in aviation, those are his words, to buy a motorcycle, which the client could not use because the client didn't have a driver's license, and which he used over one summer before selling it, to buy himself football tickets to Badger games and to Green Bay Packer games. The client was supposed to get the benefit of it. He got the benefit of about $250 of the $650 that was taken from the client trust account, and the remaining $450 or so just remained available for Mr. Knickmeyer to use personally and wasn't credited back to the client until after this investigation began. So when we talk about an unorthodox, personally generated procedure, we're talking about a procedure that basically utilizes client trust funds for the benefit of the lawyer and not at all for the benefit of the client. And continuing on that issue, I believe it bears not just on the existence of the violation, but also on the discipline to be imposed. Mr. Knickmeyer has, from the inception of the investigation right through the last time he submitted a writing, indicated that he thought he did the right thing, that he was the only person who looked out for the client, and that this was his way of not just looking after the client, but doing heroic things for Madison's East Side by keeping money out of the hands of drug dealers. And on the question of the violation, I think it's very clear that he shouldn't have had his money in the first place. When he borrowed the money from Mr. Reinke, he did not disclose to Mr. Reinke the kind of information which, had he disclosed it to a bank, he wouldn't have gotten the loans. He had filed multiple bankruptcy petitions. He owed huge amounts of monies to others, to the Internal Revenue Service, to the state of Wisconsin. It's in one of the exhibits. and he hadn't paid that back. He was massively in debt, and he didn't disclose that to his client. It's, if you borrow money from a commercial lender, they give you an application, and they say, what are your debts? I mean, that's like lending 101. And you would think that before an attorney borrows money from a client to whom he owes a fiduciary duty, who he would at the very least disclose that kind of information. And that, of course, that his failure to do so is what underlies the deceit, misrepresentation, and fraud charges in the complaint. So he gets, now, that's part one on the violations. In terms of the discipline to be imposed, this notion that he did, this continuing notion that, you know, this was heroic conduct which deserves to be praised, there is a statutory procedure for dealing with clients who can't control their funds. The referee judicially noted it, and during the questioning of Mr. Knickmeyer, I asked him questions about Mr. Reinke. Was he this, that, and the other thing, which were basically the statutory terms for a spendthrift? And he said, yes, yes. And so it is in the record that Mr. Reinke qualified for the statutory procedure. And you would think that a lawyer would follow that procedure. I mean, we're supposed to apply the law, and the legislature has spoken to this problem. But somehow Mr. Knickmeyer felt that that wasn't a good idea, and so he superimposed his own unorthodox, personally generated program, which, of course, entailed all these wonderful benefits to him. Now, I think it should also be clear that that's really not true. That doesn't explain what happened here, and I'll give you several examples as to why that is so. First of all, in early 1999, in connection with the matter in which he was representing Mr. Reinke, there was a sale of some land from Mr. Reinke's mother's estate, which generated about $45,000. And that was put into the trust account on March 1st of 1999. That same date, an agreement was reached between Mr. Reinke and Mr. Knickmeyer, which was supposed to deal with the disbursement of that $45,000. And among the things it said was that after $800 in legal fees, monies were not to be dispersed from this account without the written or oral consent of the client. On that same day, about, I think it was amount, $531, was withdrawn to pay for some telephone bills that Mr. Knickmeyer had. And the very next day, about $831 for legal fees. So within 2 days, that agreement was breached. And it was breached for Mr. Knickmeyer's benefit, and there's no rational or logical way in which you can say this was for the benefit of a spendthrift client, because Mr. Reinke is in prison.
Counselor, I want to shift your focus a little bit back to the summary suspension concerns that were raised by Mr. Knickmeyer. Does due process require a hearing either before or shortly after a summary suspension of a law license?
In my view, it requires a hearing if there's something to be heard. And what happened here was an affidavit in support of the motion for temporary suspension was filed, which set forth certain allegations which obviously OLR considered very serious. There was a response that was filed by Mr. Knickmeyer, and it didn't generate...
You ordered a show cause from the court to...
Yes, the court indicated that he should show cause why he should not be temporarily suspended, and he responded, but it was not in a manner that created a significant factual question.
Is there any obligation on the part of OLR to give him notice that he might have a hearing, or is it solely up to him to raise the issue and request one?
Well, you know, I think, again, going back to your earlier question, a hearing to do what? If it's, he has a due process right, if he controverts the facts, I think he does have a due process right for this court not to say, hey, we accept Nancy Warner's version of the facts, not Mr. Knickmeyer's, because we like her affidavit better. That, I think, could violate due process. And so the court would have to put in place some mechanism to resolve the factual dispute before continuing with the conceitedly severe result of a temporary suspension. But that didn't happen here.
But is there any obligation on our part to give notice to him that a hearing could be had at his request?
Well, I don't believe so. I mean, again, if he doesn't, I think the need for a hearing either is there constitutionally or it's not. If he doesn't controvert the facts in any significant way, then if this Court wants to resolve the question on the paper record, as it did, it is certainly free to do so without violating his constitutional rights. If there is a dispute of the facts that's significant, then I think this Court does have to hold a hearing. And it's notice to him doesn't make any difference. It, either the requirement exists or it doesn't. So I don't. So the my answer to Your Honor's question is no. I don't think OLR has to notify him of his right to a hearing because he may not have a right if the facts are not in dispute.
Okay. So what you're saying is that depending on what his affidavit says depends upon whether OLR must give him a hearing.
OLR what?
Depending on what his affidavit says in response to the order to show cause, that's the criteria upon which you base your opinion that that decides whether OLR gives him a hearing or not.
Yes. If you look at his response in conjunction with the documentation that it responds to, that's correct.
All right. Thank you. I think I understand.
Counsel, does his response include an admission that the continued practice of law poses a threat to the interests of the public and the administration of justice? Or does it just include an admission to some of the underlying violations asserted here?
Well, I think it acknowledges some of the underlying violations. I think the conclusion, obviously this is a conclusion. It's not a fact question. OLR decided early on that given the nature of the violations that were at that point apparent to them, that there indeed was a danger in his continued practice of law to the public, and then it was for this Court to decide, based on the facts that were presented to it, whether indeed that was correct.
Whether indeed those facts, as a matter of law, constituted a threat to the interest of the public and the administration of justice such that he should be suspended and deprived of his property interest.
Well, that's correct.
I assume, but I might be wrong. I mean, I assume by reading all this that he was contesting that his continued practice of law would be a threat to the public.
I think that that's implicitly so, but I don't know what a hearing would generate that would further enlighten this Court on that question. I mean, once you take the conduct and filter out that which is not in dispute, whether the continued practice of the law by a person who is engaged in that conduct represents a threat to the public is a conclusion that is drawn by whoever has the burden of deciding the issue.
But
no less so, for example, than when a party asks for a preliminary injunction or a temporary restraining order, is there irreparable injury? I mean, that's something which a trial judge has to decide based on the facts that are presented.
Yes, but then we get into the prompt hearing, and here, of course, any hearing that was held was 20-some months after the initial suspension. But my concern is, even if there is an admission to violations of the code, is there no room left to argue the circumstances of those violations such that the admitted violations would not pose an immediate and such a substantial threat to the public for continued practice? I mean, isn't there some room for, I messed up my trust account, but let me explain the circumstances for messing up my trust account. Or, I did take the loan, but let me explain the circumstances. I admit the violation. There's no statutory defense necessarily, or rule defense, but the circumstances would not, in their totality, if had an opportunity to be heard, necessarily result in the legal conclusion that it was necessary to immediately suspend in order to protect the public.
The order to show cause which this court issued was not an order to show cause why there were no rule violations. The order to show cause was why the relief that was requested by OLR should not be granted. So indeed, if there were circumstances, personal circumstances in Mr. Knickmeyer's life that might have explained these violations as somewhat aberrational and something that would not give cause for concern that if they would continue, he was certainly free, not just free, but obviously under, you know, it was very much in his interest to present them to the court so that when the court reviews the record after he makes a submission, if then the court decides, you know, this is all true, this shouldn't have done it, but there appear to be extenuating circumstances, then the court is certainly free to deny the request of OLR. But that's the order to show cause, I think, permits precisely the kind of factual development that Your Honor is concerned with, but it didn't happen here.
Let me just ask a more general question. Mr. Knickmeyer's brief deals with the due process issue. The due process issue is, as I understand it, pending in the Seventh Circuit, with a hearing scheduled in July? Question mark. You did not brief the constitutional issue here. The court has asked Mr. Knickmeyer a number of questions about the constitutional issue and has asked you questions about the constitutional issue involving the temporary suspension. So, one, is it an issue the court should take up? Two, if it is an issue that the court should take up now, do you want to brief it?
All right. The answer to the first question is no, I don't think you should take it up because it's essentially moot. If this court accepts the referee's recommendation and imposes and follows the recommendation of the referee, then OLR certainly has no objection to making the effective date of that law license revocation June 14, 2001. We're not saying that you have to do it on the date when you reach that conclusion, thereby mooting the question. If you should decide that the decision of if you should decide not to follow the decision of the recommendation of the referee, then if your final decision is for a period of suspension of more than 2 years and 10 months, then it's also moot. If you decide that the period of suspension should be less, then the period of temporary suspension is over. So no matter what happens in this case, this is not an issue that's before the court.
Well, let's say we decide the period of suspension should be 3 years. You know, we look at some of the other cases in our compendium of cases with this kind of a situation, say 3 years suspension. So the temporary suspension started in June 2001. And let's say that maybe we don't reach a decision until beyond the three-year period. And so the temporary suspension actually lasts longer than what we think that the discipline is warranted. How does that play out?
Well, I think,
out of luck?
I mean, that's certainly theoretically something that could happen. I don't think it will happen, but that's not really an answer to your question. If it happens, it's sad. It's unfortunate. That's something that shouldn't happen. And I, you know, it would be, it would be an unfortunate thing, and there's no way I think one could defend that. I do believe, however, that OLR is not hot to trot to bring these temporary suspension matters before the court. And I think OLR does it only if it genuinely feels that the underlying conduct does indeed pose a serious threat to the public if unchecked, and that the ultimate discipline will more than cover the period of suspension.
I mean, with the dates I gave you, I suppose unless we issue, if we thought 3 years was a, you know, adequate amount, if this case wasn't decided or released by the court until June 15th, you'd be beyond the three-year suspension.
That's right.
You know? And you said there's no way you could defend that. I mean, I heard you say I didn't say I couldn't defend it.
I think I can defend
it. Should defend it, maybe.
I'm just saying that would be an unfortunate result, you know, that he ends up being suspended from the practice of law more than this court feels appropriate. I think it's defensible because I think the procedures that were used here are entirely justified in that he was given every opportunity to challenge OLR's factual and legal basis for the claim that he should not be allowed to practice pending the formal hearing. I should also note in that connection that if we miss by a few months, that when we had our scheduling conferences before the referee in this case, all the dates that were arrived at were consensual. There was no request by Mr. Knickmeyer that, you know, when we suggested Labor Day or the week before or after Labor Day, that he said, well, wait a minute, I'd like this to happen sooner. He agreed to those dates, and as I say, there was never an issue with that. And if anything, at one point in the proceedings, he was inclining towards bifurcating the process, that is to have a determination as to whether there was a violation, then to have a gap, and then to have the disciplinary part of the hearing continue, which would have entailed a further elongation of the whole period. So it's not as if there was ever any request by Mr. Knickmeyer to expedite things in light of the fact that he was being temporarily suspended once the complaint was filed in this case. I would like to address this question of the discipline, because it is OLR's view that 3 years is really not enough to protect the public in this case. One of the reasons I've already alluded to, namely this ongoing concept by Mr. Knickmeyer that his personally substituted procedures for the statutory procedures is okay, that's just a terrible attitude for a lawyer and doesn't augur well for his continued practice of the law. In addition to that, it's also, I think, the inaccuracy of his claim that he was acting on behalf of Mr. Reinke. And I've talked about one thing, the failure, his withdrawal of trust funds immediately after those monies were put into his account in violation of the agreement under circumstances that can in no way, shape, or form be said to benefit Mr. Reinke and his spendthrift proclivities. The other thing is, I think Justice Wilcox alluded to in his questions, relates to the delinquent tax bills. Mr. Reinke went into prison sometime in the late summer or fall of 1999. Let me get this exact date. Yeah, in October of 1999. And one of the things he asked Mr. Knickmeyer to do was to look after his one significant asset, a house. And Mr. Reinke is in jail. And as we get into the latter part of 2000, there is a letter from the tax authority saying that the owner is delinquent in the taxes. And it was in response to that that Mr. Knickmeyer said, we have liquidity problems. Now, at that time, in the fall of 2000, the airplane loan, the $12,000 loan, was already over 1 year past due. It was the loan was taken in September of 1998. It was due in September of 1999. So by the time we get to this notice from the tax authority that the taxes are due, it's more than a year overdue. And Mr. Reinke is pleading with Mr. Knickmeyer, please, you've got my money. I'm in jail. I don't want the state to foreclose on my property. Please take care of this. Now, he doesn't. And it's important to appreciate that that's not money going to Mr. Reinke. I mean, he's in jail to begin with, or he's in prison to begin with, but even if he weren't, he's not giving Mr. Reinke money to do whatever Mr. Reinke does with it. It's a matter of paying the taxes, the state taxes or the real estate taxes. But he didn't do it. He said, we have a liquidity problem. Yeah, I think he had a liquidity problem. I mean, that loan was over a year due. The You know, the motorcycle loan, which was taken out in May of 1999, was over a year due. Yeah, he had a liquidity problem all right. He couldn't pay him back. And when he did finally pay him back at the inception of the hearing, his testimony was that he paid him back with funds which he borrowed from his parents. Now, that's unfortunate, but the point is the liquidity problem was right here. And it's not surprising. If you borrow money from clients when you have debts all over the place, it really isn't that astonishing that when those debts are due, you can't pay them.
Counsel, who's here to defend that kind of conduct? I think in some ways there is a defense that was asserted, but in other ways he admitted it initially, some of the violations, I think, and the amended complaint, there was a contest. The referee found all of the violations except the two, 16 and 18, which I think he threw out, if I remember correctly. So there are a couple that weren't found, even though they were brought. But I understand that most of his complaint isn't necessarily with the underlying violations, but rather the procedures that were employed here and the discipline that is to be meted out. With regard to that latter issue, discipline to be meted out, tell me why this case is not like the Gilbert case. As I recall the Gilbert case, because you were talking about taking money from clients, and as I recall the Gilbert case, and then others may recall that case also, that case involved an attorney who got, I think, a 2-year suspension. And the allegations were for 6 months of work that that attorney who represented an elderly gentleman who was at least portrayed as very vulnerable, that attorney billed $112,000 for 6 months of work, including the allegation was taking money to buy a television for her family, you know, not an airplane, but a television. And it was 2 years suspension. So why is that, if I recall also, it was asserted that $112,000 that she billed to this elderly gentleman for 6 months constituted one-third of his entire net estate. So why is that all that different?
Well, it is different for several reasons. First of all, it is different because Ms. Narainka persists in the view which led to the problem in the first place, namely, Mr. Knickmeyer, namely that, you know, I did the right thing here in saving this client from himself. I think that's one thing that distinguishes it from the Gilbert case. There's also, in terms of the way he sees himself, I mean, if you look at his answers, which he withdrew what he said, but it's not like he was 18 years old when he said in his answer that our claims, that what he admitted, namely failure to keep records, were technical de minimis violations. We're talking about not making entries in the check ledger when he writes checks. And that, he says, is a technical de minimis violation up until the hearing when he said, well, you know, I have to back off that. Of course you have to back off that. But you have to consider that this is an adult who, until he backed off that, felt that not keeping these very fundamental records was a technical de minimis violation. He felt that the allegations with respect to the football tickets where he uses client monies to buy all these tickets, the client uses $200 and there's $450 left over that he uses for his benefit and doesn't pay back until after the proceedings here have begun, I think he called that a concoction of OLR that has no basis in fact or in law. That's what an adult Mr. Knickmeyer said. Now, what does that tell you about this man? He testified in his deposition that why didn't he keep records? Well, he said at the time, I am so honest. I am more honest and more ethical than any other lawyer. Therefore, I didn't have reason to think I would ever get caught. And so I didn't bother keeping the records. You know, that's what his answer was in the deposition, which is in the when he was questioned at the hearing, of course, he acknowledged saying that. So that's in the transcript, too. You have, in this case, I think, and I don't think you have that in the Gilbert case, you have an attitude which sort of justifies the kind of conduct that took place here, which can give you no assurance at all that it's not going to happen again. I mean, he's not 18 years old or 28 years old. He's not just starting off in a practice. He's been doing this, practicing for many years, and I think the protection of the public factor would suggest that is this the kind of man that should be practicing law who has these views about himself and about the requirements that we impose on lawyers? I mean, Mr. Reinke wanted to know, where do I stand? When he finally gave him his bill, it was 2 years afterwards. There was no bill for 2 years. That's a technical de minimis violation. So that's what we're dealing with here, and that's why I think why OLR fairly early on decided that this is a problem, and why I think that this court should acquiesce that yes, this is a very serious problem, and that the far more serious discipline in 2 years is warranted.
What were the prior disciplines of Mr. Knickmeyer?
I'm sorry?
Was he previously disciplined?
Yes, he has been previously disciplined twice. Once for a violation somewhat similar to the violations here, that is of utilizing trust monies before the services that warranted the disbursement of the funds actually took place, which is what happened here too, with respect to not just Mr. Reinke, but another client. In the case of the other client, Mr. Knickmeyer acknowledged at the hearing, he acknowledged the violation. That was a private reprimand. There was another private reprimand for Mr. Knickmeyer having developed an infatuation with a 17-year-old client, and when she was 18, asking her to travel with him, and then continuing on and not getting out of the thing in time, for which he was also privately reprimanded. So you have two prior brushes with OLR with the Board of Attorneys. And they didn't seem to have much of an effect. I mean, because the very violation that took place with respect to record keeping happened here as well. Ms. Warner did an analysis of his late 2000 reconstruction of what happened in early 1999. All of the records here that we have were reconstructed by Mr. Knickmeyer after he was notified of the grievance, and they involved reconstructing things that took place almost a year and a half earlier. And even if you take those records and you look at his billing records as reconstructed, he withdrew monies from the Reinke trust account that were not warranted by the bills he submitted. And you, for example, on two occasions, he took $1,100 out of that $45,000 and marked down, as he reconstructed it a year and a half later on, as a principal advance to himself. What is that? Well, he said it was an addendum to the loan he had already taken. That's it. Was there any documentation from Mr. Reinke indicating an assent to that? No. What were the terms? Well, he says it was a continuation of the prior loan. Well, that's very nice, but where do we see that in the paper? Nowhere. But when it came to getting a receipt for a $20 payment to Mr. Reinke, he was very quick to get documentation of that. So we see here an attorney who has absolutely no regard for the fact that there are procedures and rules that have to be followed, and he hasn't done it. And I think that's an additional factor and a very important factor that the court should consider. The other thing, and I see my time is up, so unless there are any questions, I'll stop.
I just have one question, if I might.
Yes, Justice Brooks.
Are you able to point us to any case from the compendium that might be similar to this case where revocation was indeed the sanction?
I have not done so.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Jerkheim. Mr. Knickmeyer?
Thank you, Your Honor. Members of the court, I will be brief since I believe I only have 5 minutes. I'd like to start out, Mr. Turkheimer covered a lot of ground, on two things where I agree with what the Office of Lawyer Regulation did or their position, and these may just be my interpretation of what they did, but in terms of the appropriate discipline, in my response submitted back in March of 2001, in response to the order to show cause, I recommended a kind of a compromise resolution
That's record item number 61, I believe. And I said, impose conditions. Impose conditions, no handling of client funds, no transactions of whatever nature and so forth. And the respondent appellant is able to understand those conditions and would gladly abide by them. And it appears to me that that would resolve the concerns that have been voiced. This was also renewed in arguments before the referee, and the referee doesn't seem to discuss that in his decision. But to the credit of the Office of Lawyer Regulation, it is my impression that they have never, in writing, certainly, and either orally, really opposed that or stated that no conditions wouldn't work because you'll just violate them or something of that nature. And as I indicated in a response in some of the proceedings before we got to this level, we had the period from September 2000 when the investigation commenced until June 2001. Now, if the respondent appellant were such a high-risk bad guy, he would have run amok during that period. I mean, get this letter and these concerns and so forth. I mean, presumably the respondent appellant would have absconded with the funds or would have engaged in some more of these activities over that relatively long time. And then also we have the motion coming in February of 2001 along with the order to show cause dated February 21st, 2001. There's a long time between that and June, and we had an opportunity to see what the respondent appellant's going to do during that time.
Mr. Knickmeyer, you were temporarily suspended in February 2001.
And June, Your Honor. June 14, 2001.
All right. What happened to the how many clients did you have approximately when you were
about suspended? 36, Your Honor, that had active pending matters that received certified letters from me pursuant to the Supreme Court rules. And since you mentioned that, it was rather difficult to have to suddenly not be able to do anything to resolve cases. It's a personal note.
What have you done? How have you earned a living since you were suspended?
I've had a few miscellaneous things. I've done a little substitute teaching in public and private schools. As it turns out, very shortly after the suspension, my mother was taken quite ill, and I had been intermittently staying at my parents' residence anyway, which adjoins my residential lot, which presently has no house on it. And basically, I guess we could say I've been doing odd jobs, trying to collect some back bills, and taking care of my mother. I have not practiced law in the federal courts, where apparently it's acknowledged I'm still authorized and admitted to practice, including the Western District Court here, the Seventh Circuit, and the U.S. Supreme Court. That has been discussed. That has been considered pursuing. That has been a couple of letters sent, but I haven't actually had a single case in any court where I haven't been a party, Your Honor. The other thing I wanted to say that I very much credit Office of Lawyer Regulation with, and something I think the referee was unaware of, according to my reading, nowhere in the initial report or anywhere was it ever alleged that the respondent appellant had the intent to deceive directed toward the client or anybody else. And we got in a section of the brief deals with that. That's almost unique. And they never took that position. And I think it's because of legitimate investigative tactics that they pursued of talking to a lot of former clients and looking through hundreds of pages of material and deposing me personally face to face. And I credit them very much, and that's true. And the other thing is, nobody's ever come up with any misrepresentation that actually was allegedly made by the respondent appellant at any time, at least according to my interpretation. And there's none suggested in the report. The basis for the dishonesty charges regarding disclosures was simply that omissions, negligent, inadvertent, whatever reason, solely the basis. And we did have some legal authorities and things going back and forth on that. And that's all the time I have. And I thank the members of the court once again.
Thank you, Mr. Knickmeyer, for presenting your case to the court this morning. And thank you, Mr. Turkheimer, for presenting the OLR position this morning. That concludes our hearing in 02-2438-D, OLR versus Knickmeyer. The court will take a few moments recess because I think we have roughly 40 students from East Troy High School who will